Okay, we are live on streaming on YouTube now. Don, if you don't mind, I do have just a couple of quick announcements.
Okay.
This is class 4 of 6 that is flying by. And so tonight is class 4, and since this is how to meditate, I just wanted to remind everyone that there are so many opportunities for meditation practice. Just go to the Kadampa Center website, kadampa-center.org. And if you go to the calendar, that's kind of the easiest way to find things. At least I think so. You may have your own special way of navigating the website, but the calendar button is up in the top right-hand corner of the website. If you go to that, you can see that meditation is being offered every Monday through Friday morning from 7:30 to 8:30. You need to register to get a Zoom link, and then on Mondays and Thursdays, there's very limited space, but if you wanted to go on-site, they are allowing 10 people in the Gampa now for Monday and Thursday morning meditation. But otherwise, you can do it right from home simply by registering and getting that Zoom link. And then on the first Saturday of each month, there's also an opportunity for meditation from 9:30 to 11. So that's a longer one. Again, that is also during through Zoom. And then there's a Sunday morning meditation circle in the morning before Sunday Dharma with Geshe Gelug. So that Sunday morning meditation circle is from 9 to 9:45, and then Sunday Dharma with Geshe Gelug starts at 10:30 and goes until noon. So lots and lots of opportunities. There's also a Tara practice coming up this Saturday. That one's from 1 until 2. Again, for all of these, to get the Zoom link, just go on the website and register online, and you will get that Zoom link sent to you. So again, lots of opportunities. Take advantage, and now I'll go ahead and turn it over to Don. Thanks, Don.
All right, thank you. Let's do the prayers.
Okay.
And you can show those. I have to pull this up on my computer. So we'll do the taking refuge and generating bodhicitta for measurables in the mandala offering. And again, just so I had a friend who stopped coming to Kadampa Center, or at least, yeah, I mean, during the, she was one of the earliest students, and she just, she said, I just can't stand all the ritual, and the prayers were part of it. And so some people, they resonate with the prayers, but the whole point of it, the prayers, is to help us set our motivation, to generate a little bit of positive karma, put our mind in a good place so that we can get the maximum benefit from whatever Dharma practice that follows during the prayers. So that's the point. And again, refuge in bodhicitta is, refuge is distinguishing where we go for. In troubled times, do we seek refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, or in drug, sex, and rock and roll? You know, it's kind of like, where do you go? Where do you go in a hailstorm? Do you go to a shelter, or do you stay out there and get pelted to death? So, you know, refuge is a place of safety. And we go there, we take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha for three reasons. As I said, you know, first is a dread, understanding that we create mostly negative karma in our lives, and the future, given the negative karma that we've created, is going to be difficult. It's going to be really difficult if we don't do something about it. And so out of some dread of the consequences of those negative actions, we're looking for a valid source of refuge, some some source of protection or guidance, and so that we, and then we have confidence in the Buddha Dharma and Sangha, that the Buddha was enlightened, and the you know, we can learn from the Buddha's teachings and example how to achieve what he did, and then the Dharma or the teachings and the realizations of those teachings in the Sangha or the spiritual community that support us. So again, it's kind of, sometimes I said fear and confidence. And then lastly, compassion. So that's where we go, excuse me, that's where we take, do these prayers. The first one, and the second one is immeasurable love, immeasurable compassion, immeasurable joy, and immeasurable equanimity. So do these with these little bits of awareness in our mind. I go for refuge and till I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. And by the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Excuse me. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be free. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this as a Buddha filling offer. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Radha Mandala Kamni Yata Yami. Now, so as Linda was saying, there's so many opportunities to meditate. And again, yeah, I think it's important in the very beginning, I know it is, to set your motivation for practice. Otherwise, the purpose of meditation is not just to calm yourself down, really. I mean, that's one of the beneficial effects, but it's not the purpose from our perspective, or from the Mahayana Buddhist perspective. The purpose of meditation is to help us achieve supreme enlightenment in order to be able to help others. And of course, most of us don't think we have that kind of potential, which is a kind of ignorance that we all possess, is our lack of confidence in our ability to to achieve these states of higher and higher states of happiness, and to be free of the suffering that we experience, and then the ability to help others endlessly. I mean, with perfect compassion, wisdom, skillful means and power, all those qualities that an enlightened being possesses, we have some potential. We can see that, and it can be cultivated and grown endlessly until we become a Buddha. But it takes time and it takes effort. It's not easy. If it was easy, we'd be there already, wouldn't we? So let's do some simple meditations to begin with. The breathing meditations. Last week, we did the non-round breathing. And so I'm going to embellish this a little bit with some, I don't know how many people you know, maybe the people that do yoga are familiar with the psychic channels or nadis, but there are two of them that are about the size of a straw, and they start at the nose. They go back, they curve back like the handle of a umbrella, curved umbrella, and they go right beside the spinal cord, all the way down 4 finger breaths below the navel, and then there's a central channel that's I've heard some people say it starts here, but other teachings say it starts here, and it again goes back, and it's bigger than the nadis, and it goes into the central channel, and it goes down in front of the spinal cord, again, 4 finger breaths below the navel. And we imagine that these two little straw-like channels join the central channel, 4 finger breaths below the navel. And I'm going to describe the meditation using this visualization of these channels, these psychic channels. These types of Kundalini meditation practices, they become more, you don't see it much in the sutra teachings, but it becomes more and more important in the tantric teachings, particularly the completion stage, where you're working with the energy of the mind more than the conceptual aspects of the mind. So it's the psychic channels and breaking up any sort of obstructions so that the winds of the mind flow freely through these channels. This may sound a little bit crazy, but this is what the teachings say. So we begin by visualizing these three psychic channels within our body through which the wind energy moves. The channels are round and hollow, the size of a straw, and very fine, smooth, flexible, and luminous. The central channel is blue. The right channel is red, and the left channel is white. The left and right channels run from the left and right nostrils, run along the spine to the end 4 finger breaths below the navel. The blue channel, the central channel, runs from a point midway between the eyebrows down along the spine, also to the point 4 finger widths below the navel. For this meditation, visualize that the ends of the right and left channels join the central channel at the point 4 finger breaths below the navel. A lot of times we'll, you know, when in Tibetan Buddhism, we try to make a little triangle. You know, the right hand goes on top of the left and the thumbs touch. And so normally, that's about, if you put your thumbs right at the level of the navel, that's about the palms are 4 finger breaths below the navel. And that kind of helps focus your mind and your energy if you want to try that technique. So for this meditation, we're going to start out by holding the left nostril closed with the index finger and inhale slowly and fully through the right nostril, sending the breath all the way down to the end of the right channel. You can do that now. Imagine that the breath flows from the right to the left channel as you move your index finger to hold the right nostril closed, and exhale slowly and fully through the left nostril. As the breath leaves the left nostril, imagine that all impurities, such as distractions and mental dullness, are expelled with the breath. So repeat this 2 more times, so I won't talk as you do it the next couple of times. Now reverse the process, holding the right nostril closed with your index finger. Take a deep breath through your left nostril, sending the breath all the way down to the end of the left channel. As the breath moves into the central channel, move your index finger to hold the left nostril closed and exhale slowly and fully through the right nostril. As the breath leaves the right nostril, imagine that all impurities are expelled with the breath. So we'll do this twice more. Now inhale slowly and deeply through both nostrils, sending the air down the side channels. The breath is then exhaled up the central channel. Breathe out, expelling all impurities through both nostrils. Repeat twice, three breaths in all. So do that one now. Now imagine that the three channels are completely clean and luminous. Keep breathing gently and evenly, imagining your breath flowing freely through these channels. And we're going to do another one of our meditations that we practiced before, and that's counting the breath. We'll go up to 10. Sometimes the Tibetans say out is, you kind of mentally, you breathe out and breathe in, and that's one. Breathe out and in, that's two, like that. So you go that way up into 10. And of course, if anybody makes it to 10, it'll be a miracle. Most people get lost after two or three breaths, which is fine. The point is not, this is not a competition. Very difficult to keep the mind focused on anything very long. So when we lose the focus, or we lose count, we just simply bring the divine back to the breath and start all over again. So we'll do this for a few minutes. And the point is not just the count, but it's to keep the awareness on the whole experience of the inhalation and exhalation. You know, from the beginning of the inhalation, or the, let's say from the beginning of the exhalation, it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And then as the breath turns and we inhale again, but never losing the focus of the breath and mentally counting softly, one, as the breath turns, it has a beginning and a middle, and then we complete the inhalation. Again, the breath sort of turns, and we exhale, mentally thinking two, just gently mentally labeling exhalation two. So do that again, but again, bring your focus in a little tighter on the whole experience of breathing, not just the numbers, but the whole beginning, middle, and end of every breath, up to 10 if possible. there's another meditation that we haven't done with the breath that's particularly helpful if you're feeling distracted or sleepy. And as you exhale, imagine that you exhale black, thick black smoke, which represents all your mental dullness and distractions, preoccupations, physical and mental discomfort, so that the exhalation, all this negative black energy leaves your body and mind. And as you inhale, imagine you inhale bright white light, which represents mental awareness, concentration, and peaceful focus. So we'll do that for a couple of minutes. Again, exhaling, you know, our negative energy and inhaling positive energy. And the last meditation we're going to do is one to develop mindfulness. And this is probably the one that, I think a lot of people are familiar with it when they talk about Vipassana, or a lot of the mindfulness meditation practices, or basically this type of meditation that we're going to talk about. I remember one, I think, I don't know if I told this story, but anyway, I met this monk who had done a 3-year retreat, and it was really based on mindfulness practice. And his, I said, what was the big thing you got out of the retreat? And he'd been in isolation for 3 years, basically, to do this retreat. And he said that just how the mind is constantly in a state of flux and change, and the body is too, but he just said impermanence, subtle impermanence of every feeling, sensation, thought, whatever comes into the mind, it only lasts for an instant, and then something else is there. Constantly changing. So just keep that in mind. Your breath is the anchor for your attention. And with a corner of your mind, be aware of the different mental and physical sensations that arise. We just merely observe them without getting involved. We're curious about them. The mind gets taken away, which it often will, by a thought or some memory or some sound may, you know, bring back memories and past experiences, and the mind goes off. You can actually use that as the focus just by stepping back and noticing that whatever's going on in the mind, you know, you can sometimes label it. Thinking, you know, very softly mentally, label thinking, and gradually it just ceases to exist. And now you're back with the experience of breathing. If you have pain in your knee or your neck, or there's some sort of tingling in your foot, you might say, you know, pain, or tingling in the foot, just lightly, mentally labeling whatever the experience it is that's dominating your awareness at the moment. Sometimes this process is called choiceless awareness, because we don't really know what's going to arise in our experience from moment to moment. But we just notice it without getting involved, kind of a little, being able to step back a little bit as the mind, and notice how the mind and our sensations, bodily sensations, sound, all the senses, whatever input we have is constantly in a state of flux, change. If you're bored, if you think, gosh, this is so boring, then just label that mentally. Notice what the experience of boredom is, and mentally label that bored. Just gently label that, and notice how that experience changes from moment to moment. as our mindfulness becomes more subtle, we will become aware of the beginning, the duration and sensation we'll become aware of the beginning and the duration and cessation of sensations, thoughts, feelings, emotions, and notice that they're constantly changing, and there is a moment, the first moment of whatever it is that we're experiencing, and then it'll disappear, and then we're into something else as we become more aware. But again, not being caught up in it, just observing. Mindfully, just paying attention. Okay, you can relax your concentration, make a little dedication to having made some effort to calm and focus our minds. May we quickly generate positive qualities and remove all negativities and obscurations. And may you quickly awaken to the state of supreme enlightenment to lead all beings to that supreme state. I believe, by the way, if these meditations are in the readings that go along with the course, so you can find them there if you wanted to have a resource for that. Anybody have any thoughts or questions about their meditation practice? Anything over the last week come up that was, comments, anything?
Feel free to unmute if you do have a question.
The discipline of getting myself at a regular time in the morning, which I hadn't been doing since you raised it clearly last time, has made it easier. And the stuff we just got today about the breathing and what you're thinking of the breath, it just comes easier now. Once I started making myself do it every day, now I'm not making it. You know, I'm doing it, so it's not work like it was initially. I don't know if that's making me.
Good.
I think that's beautiful, Gary. I like that. I'm not making it, I'm doing it. That's great.
It's practice, isn't it? That's what we call it, practice. And now we get better. We get better. I mean, when I started doing the counting of breath, I swear, if I got to three, it was a good meditation. I couldn't get past three to save my life. We used to do the refuge prayer three times. I would get lost after the first. I couldn't remember whether I was doing the second or third time. That's how distracted my mind was when I first got introduced to Buddhism. It's a little better now. I'll say that. Anything about anything really? How about the practices that you did this past week? I gave people, do you remember, Linda, do you remember which numbers I gave people to do?
Yeah, it looks like last week was the 3 through 8.
See, 3 through 8?
D, as in D. Dog.
Oh, yeah, D. D, 3 through 8. Okay, good. Perfect. Perfect. So let's go over that. Does anybody have any, well, let's go over it for us, and I'll talk about briefly about each one of those points, and we'll do a little meditation on each of them. But refuge, in Buddhism, we talk about refuge in Buddhas, the enlightened beings, the Dharma, which we think of like a book, like this is a Dharma book, right? But the word Dharma means that which separates beings from suffering. And from the Buddhist perspective, when we're taking refuge in the Dharma, we're taking refuge in the realizations of the teachings in the minds of holy beings. And then the Sangha is like the helpers, the spiritual community. So sometimes they talk about the Buddha. The Buddha is like the good doctor, and the Dharma is like the medicine, and the Sangha are like the nurses, the ones that give us the medicine and help support our practice, like that. And but you know, when we, so oftentimes, you know, we'll do the, you know, we'll do like this, and then at the center you'll see people do prostrations. And so we're not, and there'll be statues up in front, and some people who've never been there before will think, oh my God, they're bowing down to graven images. This is so terrible. You know, because that's not supposed to do that, right? Nobody, at least, the point is not to see these chunks of metal which are, which is what they are, as like something magical or anything like that. But really they are imbued in some way because they've been blessed with some sacred or holy energy, but that's not the point of it. To remind us, and this is the best way to take refuge, is to realize that we're taking refuge in the enlightened beings, right? The Buddhas, the enlightened beings that have fully realized their potential, but also in our own potential to be that. We're taking refuge in the realizations of the teachings in the minds of these holy beings, but also in our own potential to do that. And we're taking refuge in the Sangha, the spiritual community. Generally, the Sangha is, you know, you think of it as monks and nuns, but as the Dharma's come to the West, you know, we all think of ourselves as, those are, you know, we're not monks and nuns, but we think of the Kadampa Center as us, you know, that's our Sangha. You know, we're there to support one another's spiritual practice. So, you know, so it's, we're taking refuge in our ability to be able to be a serve as a support and a guide for others, and the real Sangha are the so-called Arya Sangha, which are beings that have realized emptiness, and they don't necessarily have to be monks or nuns to have that realization of emptiness, but those are the beings that are the real helpers, the people that have seen reality as it is. So this is just for a moment. We'll do a couple of minutes meditation on these three things, the Buddhas and the enlightened beings, the Buddhas, but also our potential to be that, the Dharma or the realizations in the minds of these holy beings, but also our potential to have those realizations in our mind. And then the Sangha or spiritual community who help us along the way, and then our potential to become Sangha, to become an Arya being, to see reality and then truly be able to help others. So I'll do this for a minute. So we call them, we call them the three jewels. Sometimes the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, you hear, particularly Chuchen Chodron, she talks about the three jewels of refuge. So that's the Buddha's, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So the other topics that we talked about or were to think about this past week. One of them was karma. So karma is kind of like, I think maybe Dalai Lama said one time, he said, if you had a choice, there were like two teachings in Buddhism, and one of them you had to throw away and the other one you could keep. Which one would you keep? And one of them was emptiness and the other one was karma. And he said, emptiness, let it go. He said, karma is that important. Understanding law of causality, because that's what creates our reality, isn't it? Because things are completely empty. And because our karma is continually ripening, and the ripening of past imprints is what's creating our moment-to-moment experience, it's really crucial if we want to be able to shape our future to know what to do. What are the things that are going to create the causes for us to be happy, but even bigger than that, to be a bodhisattva, and even one day become a Buddha? What are those causes? How does this whole thing work, this whole karmic thing work? So my allergies. Does anybody have allergy problems this time of year? I sure do. So the first law of karma, most people who come to the center, I don't know, maybe they haven't memorized it, but it's important to memorize these things. First law of karma is that basically what goes around comes around. If you put out negative energy, it's going to be like a boomerang. It's coming back. And if you put out positive energy, it's coming back. Now, is it coming back like that, or will it take many lifetimes to come back? it's possible that some karma, now this is debatable, I've heard it debated amongst the Tibetans and certain teachers, and some people will say, well, if a karma is really, really strong and reinforced again and again, it could actually bring a fruit, the fruition of that action, be it positive or negative, could occur in this lifetime. If we get enlightened, potentially we could get enlightened in this lifetime if we really created the kind of powerful positive imprints that could ripen in this very lifetime. So positive actions lead to happiness. Negative actions lead to suffering. And in fact, that's the definition of a positive and negative actions from a Buddhist perspective. If the result of an action is happiness, then the action was positive. If the result of the action is suffering, then the action was negative. Okay? So all actions motivated by non-hatred, non-attachment, and non-ignorance will always, always, always ripen in happiness. And actions motivated by greed, hatred, ignorance, pride, jealousy, you name it, all the other 84,000 illusions, they always ripen as suffering. So that's first law of karma. It's kind of like positive happiness, negative suffering. Very important to get that one down. Then the another law of karma is that, let me see if I can remember them now. Well, here's one. You cannot experience, oh yeah, karma is expandable. Okay, great. I usually have this stuff down, but karma is expandable. It's like a little tiny acorn can become like a huge tree, huge oak tree, right? Like, and then seeds that are put into the ground, when the situation's right, the moisture and the heat and everything's just right, that seed grows exponentially. It's the same way with the karma that we create. With the karma that we create on our mind stream, those seeds grow exponentially. So a tiny act of a tiny negative action can result in ginormous future suffering. Maybe like 20 or 100 lifetimes from that could be a result in, you know, our death maybe. Whereas a tiny positive action will always, again, growing exponentially, will always lead to a future result. And if it, given enough time, could result in us having incredibly good fortune. So karma is expandable. So that's why the teachers are saying to us, watch your mind. Mama, be careful, because the seeds that we plant, even every day, just tiny little seeds that are negative, they begin to grow exponentially, okay? And we don't want the consequences of that. And we don't want to miss an opportunity to practice kindness either. Just a smile or a word of support, just any kind of positive action that we haven't, you know, maybe you're pulling off the exit ramp and there's a homeless person there who's got a sign up, you know, who says, I don't have any food, I'm homeless, you know, and you reach in the car and you grab a quarter or a dollar and you give it to them. We look for opportunities to be, to practice, virtue and avoid non-virtue, because karma is expendable. It grows exponentially. And it's why it's so important at the end of the day to practice purification. We'll touch on that in a minute, the four potent powers, because we don't want the negative karma that we've done today, we want to clean that up before we go to bed at night, because it's growing, growing, growing all the time, 24/7, this, and all through this life and lifetime and into future lifetimes, like that. Then the next one is that you cannot experience a result without having created the cause. You cannot experience a result without having created the cause. Anybody got a problem with that one? Yeah. I mean, that's a hard one, isn't it? Because there's some things in my lifetime.
I have a problem with that.
Okay.
This is where I always stumble when I look at karma. And so, for example, I'll think of children.
Mm-hmm.
Homes where they're being abused. And I'm like, how can I wrap my mind around that is something that they caused? I mean, is that what karma would say?
Good question. I think this is where understanding the continuity of consciousness and the fact that there have been countless previous lifetimes, right? Mm-hmm. And that, you know, it's possible things have happened to me in this lifetime that I can't explain, that some good, some bad, you know? But all that karma, most of the karma that we experience in this life is from former lifetimes. Very, very little of the karma, the ripenings that we experience in this life are from actions in this lifetime. Even though it appears to be so, it's, you know, the teachings say not so. So it's, you know, why would a baby be aborted? Why would a newborn baby get sick and die in the NICU? Why do some people get COVID and some people don't? Why the bad things happen to nice people? You know, why, you know, there's so many things that we cannot answer, but karma answers everything. It says, even though we may not agree with it, it's an impersonal process. It's not personal that these children are born into difficult situations, into families that are dysfunctional or whatever, and then they have such a hard life. You say, well, they're not to blame. They don't deserve that. But it's not personal. It's like this impersonal process of ripening. It's a seed that was planted in the past, maybe 50 lifetimes ago, ripening now as a suffering experience in this lifetime. And I would just have you, it's one of those, don't throw out the baby with the bathwater here, you know?
Yeah.
Don't get it. Don't give up on karma. Because actually, it's quite powerful for us to think, like, right now, I'm creating my future. Okay? I cannot experience a result without creating the cause. Well, the future cause I want is enlightenment. So I need now to create those causes. And the past is past. And we don't have to, you know, it is tough. It is a tough concept. But it really is about, for us who are trying to practice this path, taking responsibility, being accountable. You know, whatever's happened to us, not being a victim, not going, oh, how dare, look what she or he did to me, like that. But to say, that's just my karma. I remember there was this is a true story. I was listening to NPR, and this was in the early days of the AIDS epidemic, and some lady from Thailand, her husband had gotten AIDS from a prostitute in Bangkok, I think, and he passed it on to her, and now she was dying from AIDS. And the interviewer was asking her if she was mad at her husband, and she said, no, it's my karma. She didn't feel victimized. She said her point of view was that I cannot experience a result that I didn't create the cause for. And this is my karma. And I'm not going to get angry. I'm not going to get, you know, then it was amazing. Nobody could believe it. I couldn't believe it. I thought it was so courageous for her to have that and not feel like a victim, because being a victim is very, feeling victimized by any situation is, you know, is, it makes it stick. It creates a lot of anger and resentment, and it's very, very difficult to let go of anything when we feel like we're a victim. So this is one of those teachings where we get to investigate. You know, we cannot experience the result without creating cause. Just it's something to be open to. And then the last of the laws of karma is that it's never lost. The seeds of karma are never lost. So even the tiniest, again, getting back to even the tiniest act of kindness plants a seed that will grow exponentially. Until the cooperative causes come together for that seed to ripen. For example, you know, maybe 50 million lifetimes ago, you offered a piece of fruit to a beggar, you know, and now in this lifetime, you know, you like had this wild idea that this new car called Tesla was going to go a lot, was going to hit the jackpot. And so you put, you know, $100,000 in the Tesla stock before it went public. And now you're filthy rich. You know, it's like that. So tiny actions, the results of karma are never lost unless, now there's a caveat here. We can purify karma. We can purify so that we don't have to experience the full negative effect of karma. To truly purify karma, we have to completely purify it. We have to understand emptiness and actually have direct intuitive insight into emptiness. But we can weaken the negative force of former actions by doing purification, the four planet powers, which I'll talk about next. But again, positive karma will, you know, it's never lost. Positive actions, those benefits will be, those karmic seeds will ripen, and eventually the cooperative causes will come together for that karma to come to fruition. Same way with negative karma. You know, we may have the negative karma. Maybe we did something really negative in a former lifetime, and this lifetime something terrible happens to us. The cooperative causes, like the COVID virus, comes and we're not even that old. Maybe you're just like a teenager or some young person. You really haven't had a chance to experience life, but somehow you're dead now because the cooperative causes, the karma to die young, and this virus come together to ripen into your early death. So those are the four laws of karma. Positive actions, happiness; negative actions, suffering. Karma is expandable. We can't experience a result without creating the cause, and the results of karma are never lost. It's important to understand that. So just for a moment, let's think about those four things. Positive actions lead to happiness, always, and negative actions always lead to suffering. What goes around comes around. You know, it's like the golden rule. It gives some power to the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Because that's exactly what's going to happen. And then karma is expandable. So soon, tiny, you know, big actions, little actions, whatever they are, every action of our body, I mean of our mind, 24/7, we're planting seeds, negative, positive. Mostly, we're planting negative seeds. Mostly, our thoughts are self-centered and selfish. selfishly motivated. Not that we don't plant positive seeds, but if we're honest, mostly the seeds that we plant are negative, and they're expandable. And so we should have a sense of urgency to purify our negative karma. Just the tiniest act of kindness. Don't ever pass up an opportunity for a tiny act of kindness. And always be vigilant and avoid even the tiniest of negative actions. As Lama Zopa says, keep your mind in virtue as much as possible. And then we cannot, and it's rather than worry about other little children and injustices in the world, it's better to think about ourselves, just to focus on our own life and our own situation, and think we cannot experience a result without creating the cause. So everything that's happened to us in this lifetime is the fruition of former karmic seeds that could have been sown 100 billion lifetimes ago or more recently. And our future is in our hands. We cannot experience a result without creating a cause. So now is the time to create the cause for what we want, which is peace and happiness and joy and freedom. And then the consequences of karma are, karma is never lost. The seeds of karma are forever expanding exponentially. Until they ripen, or until we purify them. That's, we can purify our negative karma. It's possible to completely, in fact, to become a Buddha, we will have to have purified all our negative karma. But it's possible to do that. The principal method, which will be the realization when we have a direct intuitive insight into emptiness, we will burn through so much negative karma so fast, it would be unbelievable. But for us right now, it's the four planet powers is a good start. So again, not even the tiniest positive or the tiniest negative action is ever lost. It will eventually come to fruition, or it'll be purified. Now let's talk about the four planet powers. Before I jump into that, we don't have a lot of time left, but I want to talk about we talked about this, the non-virtues of the 10 non-virtuous actions. They say if you call yourself a Buddhist, your main job is to try to avoid the 10 non-virtuous actions. Okay? So what are the 10 non-virtuous actions? The three of body, four of speech. Of course, there are many, many more, but these are the biggies, the ones that we focus on. The three of body, four of speech, and three of mind. Okay? So the non-virtuous, so the teachings say avoid. It doesn't say thou shalt not. It says avoid. Because when we do these things, because we're ordinary beings, when we do these actions, almost guaranteed suffering. And the suffering can ripen in a future hellacious rebirth. It can ripen with us having a tendency, like if we killed in our next life, we might have a tendency to kill, or we'll have, our life will be shortened because we killed, you know, things like that. Or we'll be born in a really nasty environment, an environmental result. So every karmic action of these 10 non-virtuous actions can ripen in four different ways. But the first three of body are killing, which everybody knows what that is, taking the life of any living being, and even down to insects and probably bacteria and viruses and anything. So you have to pick your poison, right? Every day, I don't give out a lot of antibiotics, but sometimes I do. And I've talked to Lama Zopa about it, and I'm killing bacteria. I mean, are bacteria sentient beings? I don't know. But when it comes down to somebody with pneumonia, a human being with a bacteria that I think I can help somebody with, help kill or help save that person's life, I'm not going to withhold the medicine because of the... You see what I mean? We have to use our wisdom in a situation. Every situation requires us to use our good judgment. So killing, the first is killing. The second is stealing, taking that which is not freely offered. Okay? And then sexual misconduct, which is, you know, it's usually defined as adultery, having sex with somebody else's partner. But I think we could, Tipton Chodron, she says, unwise sexual activity, which I think we all know what that means. I mean, we can hurt people in a lot of different ways by our choices and the way, you know, taking advantage of people and so forth and so on with our sexuality. So the negative ones are killing and stealing and sexual misconduct and avoiding these. Now, it's kind of interesting. Virtue is, for these three, would be for killing. An act of virtue would be we're in a situation where we might kill. Let's say there's a mosquito on your arm, and you go. Normally you would just go like that, right? But you, this time you go, you know, you kind of flick it off. You restrain from killing. So restraining from the moment when you have an opportunity to kill and your instinct is to kill, and you, through mindfulness, you're aware that killing is damaging and you don't want to do that. That is an act of virtue, is restraining from killing. And another act of virtue is actually saving lives. That's also virtuous. It's another way of it's not the exact same thing, but that's how we define the 10 virtues, is restraining from killing and saving lives. So lying, like we're in a situation where we could deceive others with our speech, but we catch ourselves and we restrain ourselves. That's virtue. And when we tell the truth, and of course, sometimes telling the truth, got to be careful there, right? Because you don't want to just say everything just because it's the truth may not always be the most skillful, kind, compassionate thing to do. But generally speaking, telling the truth is virtuous. And the same way with sexual misconduct. We have an opportunity, for example, to cheat on your spouse because this other person comes along who's incredibly attractive and they're into you, and you make the decision, no, I'm not going there. Okay? That is that's virtue. You know, that's an act of virtue. So those are the three there, the three of body. The four of speech are lying, okay? Deceiving others with our speech, slander, harsh, which is bad-mouthing other people, turning people against one another, harsh speech, and frivolous speech. So the virtuous side of it, the flip side of it, is when we catch ourselves beginning to lie, we don't lie, that is an act of virtue. And then when we speak the truth, again, that's an act of virtue. So being truthful, but also restraining ourselves from deceiving others with our speech is a kind of virtue. Then there's slander, which we all know what that means, bad-mouthing other people, trying to turn people against one another. We catch ourselves, it's so easy to get, you know, when you get in a little gossip fest, and we find somebody who's not there so we can talk about them. But we catch ourselves and we don't go there. And instead, you know, we restrain ourselves, and maybe what we might do is actually speak positively about the person, or at least try to think of something, in a positive way, rather than a slanderous, negative way about other people. So that's the speech. And then, so lying, slander, harsh speech, restraining from harsh speech is virtuous. And then harmonious, kind speech is virtuous. And then gossip or frivolous speech it's not the worst, right? We all like to talk and chit chat, you know, but it's a waste of time. It's considered frivolous speech is a problem because we're wasting opportunities to practice the Dharma. So we catch ourselves when we're caught up in gossipy, frivolous, nonsensical speech. That's an act of virtue. And then when our speech has power because we're choosing our words wisely, and we're speaking in a way that's creating harmony, that's a good kind of speech. That's the kind we want to have. So again, there's lying, slander, harsh, frivolous speech. Then there's greed and hatred and ignorance. Those are the three of mine. Sometimes covetousness, which is like, I want what she has or what he has or what they want. It's all about attachment, isn't it? So we catch ourselves, covetousness is or attachment or, you know, greed is a negative state of mind. It creates a lot of problems for us. It is, you know, we talk about the Four Noble Truths, attachment or this kind of greedy mind is considered to be, you know, the main cause of our suffering. This covetous, selfish, self-centered mind. So when we catch ourselves going in that direction, being the mind is clinging, attached to whatever it might be, and we catch ourselves and we let go, that's an act of virtue. And then when we, you know, instead of coveting us or feeling, you know, greedy or selfish, we feel we're more generous, which, you know, practice generosity. That would be the opposite of that. Then there's anger or harsh, it's a mental state, right? So sometimes it's called anger. Can't think of another word that's sometimes used, but anger is good enough. So there's greed and there's anger. So when we catch ourselves getting angry or the mind of anger beginning to rise, we catch it, we stop it. That's an act of virtue. And when we practice its opposite, which is compassion and patience, patient endurance, tolerance, and even love, those are all antidotes, but they're sort of the opposite of anger, aren't they? And then ignorance in Buddhism, in this context, is so, ignorance is not just you know, not seeing reality as it is, which we call ignorance, is what we experience all the time, you know, because we don't have direct intuitive experience of emptiness. So we're constantly seeing things in a distorted way. But the ignorance we're talking about here has to do with our disbelief in our own potential for becoming happy, for achieving nirvana, for becoming enlightened, for being happier, more, a better person. Also disbelief in the laws of karma. This is like more than just, I don't believe in karma, but it's like conviction that karma is not true. Conviction that there's no past and future lifetimes. You know, strong conviction like that. That there are no Buddhas, that no one can get enlightened. It's not possible to develop perfect compassion and bodhicitta. Those are all considered to be part of what we're talking about, ignorance. And we'll catch our mind going, I mean, we can have doubt, no doubt. It's okay to doubt. It's healthy to have doubt. But at some point, it's important, I think, for Buddhists to at least creatively align with things that we don't quite understand yet. Because the teachings say that eventually, when we evolve enough, we'll be able to see the truth of karma. We'll be able to see directly the truth of past and future lifetimes. We'll be able to experience the truth of the possibility of Buddhahood. But we are limited right now with that. So we don't have that ability yet. Not there. Might have used up our time. Okay. So you get what I'm saying? So those are the 10 non-virtuous actions. This, to be a Buddhist, to call yourself a Buddhist, you at least ought to try to live by avoiding the 10 non-virtuous actions. Avoid killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, slander, harsh, frivolous talk, greed, hatred, ignorance, and practicing the opposites. Okay? Now, I'm going to touch on the four planet powers. I think we've talked about it, but I'm going to touch on them. Then next week we'll do a purification practice. We'll do a Vajrasattva purification practice. But the four planet powers, this is how we can, remember I said that karma is never lost unless it's purified? Well, this is how we can do it. So you bring to mind something, because we all have stuff that we have done maybe in the last day, maybe today, maybe this past week, or, you know, past whatever, something that's really kind of stings when you bring it to mind. And what you want to do, the first opponent power is the power of regret. And that's being willing to be honest with ourselves that what we did was negative, and that it will ripen in future suffering, and we don't want that. So we have to be really honest with ourselves about when we have practiced non-virtue. Because, for example, we always say the 10 non-virtuous actions, you go, well, I never killed anything in my life. I don't even kill insects. I haven't done that. Well, guess what? In the past lifetimes, we've all made Jeffrey Dahmer look like a saint, you know? We've been the worst mass murderer that's ever, you know, you can imagine. We've done it all. We've killed, we've stolen, we've committed sexual misconduct countless times in countless former lifetimes. This is the way the teachings start. I'm not just making this up. So we've done it all. So we might not remember having done it in this lifetime, but we've done it in past lifetimes. So we want to purify that karma, because we don't want that stuff to ripen. We want to pull those weeds out of the garden quick as we can. So the first one is regret. And just tick along those 10 non-virtuous actions and try to bring to mind if you've done any of those things, and bring to mind sincere regret. Then the second one is taking is sort of there's different ways to talk about this. I can't remember how children, but sometimes we talk about it as the power of refuge. Like usually our negative actions have been done either with respect to our teachers, our holy gurus and teachers, or with the object has been other beings. It's been either our teachers or other beings. So by taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, we can repair our relationship with the three jewels, and by developing the compassionate wish of bodhicitta, we can repair the relationship with sentient beings. So that's the second of the four planet powers. The third is the remedy. And so that could be anything from, we could do Vajrasattva mantra, you know? One of the practices, doing 100,000 Vajrasattva mantras in our tradition, the 100-syllable mantra, doing it 100,000 times. But we could just do it, you know, 21 taras. We could do any kind of spiritual practice, prostrations, any kind of spiritual practice that we want to do with this mind of purifying. Also, you know, apologizing to somebody. If you've done something to somebody and have harmed them, apologizing to them is a completely legitimate thing to do. Also, you know, giving, volunteering for some charitable organization, giving money to a charitable organization, doing something virtuous to counteract the negativity of the action is the point here. And it also shows how sincere we are about our regret that we're going to do something that's to counteract the negativity that we created. And then the fourth, and actually I've heard more than one teacher say this is the most important one of the four planet powers. Okay, the first one's regret, the second one's refuge, the third one is the remedy, and the fourth one is the resolve not to do it again. The resolve not to do it again. For how long? For as long as you can keep your word. So if you have a problem with anger and you're just one of these people that gets angry all the time, you can't say, don't make the promise that you're never going to get angry again or you're just going to create more negative karma. You're lying, right? So as much you say, for the next minute, I'm not going to get angry. Or for the next 10 seconds, I'm going to keep my mind in virtue. So the point is, make a promise to not do whatever. And we all, there's some negative actions that we're more prone to. We know what those are. So we make a promise to not follow that negative mind for some period of time that we can keep. And sometimes, you know, what I'll do is I'll say, as much as I can and for as long as I can, I'll try not to do any of the 10 non-virtuous actions. That's kind of not the best, but it is better than nothing. So we promise to refrain from anger for as long as we possibly can. Refrain from, you know, from bad-mouthing people and gossiping and all that as much as we can for as long as we can. Okay? We'll do a practice. If any of you have Vajrasattva, those little booklets that we have at the center, that would be a good practice to do this week, invoking these four opponent powers and doing Vajrasattva practice. But I would recommend that, okay? And then last but not least, so we've got the four opponent powers. Then the homework for this next week would be everything, the path in common with the middle level practitioner, everything under E is E1 through 5. Okay? That's going to be your homework for the week. You can listen to children's guided meditation on each of those points. Okay. We're probably going over. Thank you for you, those of you who hung in there for doing so. So let's do our dedication verses now. So Linda, you mind putting up those? Okay. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with the mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing and the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. May there be timely rains, a bountiful harvest. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be free from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may these never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Amen. So, thank you everyone. Have a great week. Enjoy your meditations on the various kinds of sufferings, because it's important to develop, to be aware of suffering so we can develop our compassion, the depth of our compassion will depend upon our awareness of suffering. That's, you want to keep that in mind as you do these meditations this next week. So thank you.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you, Linda. Good night, everyone.
Thank you. Bye. Thank you. Bye.